whenever I am in the study of one of my Protestant ministerial colleagues, I invariably find the 10-volume interpreter's commentary of the Bible on their shelves. It's a massive work, a running commentary to the Bible and to the New Testament, which was prepared just after the Second World War by the leading seminarians of the Protestant movement. And when the publications committee had completed all of the commentaries to the Bible, they decided to prepare a 2-volume dictionary of biblical terms, biographic, place, theological. I had occasion some time back to be leafing through that dictionary, and I was surprised to find that there were no headings under land, or promised land, or holy land, terms which have, of course, a great place in Jewish theology, in the Bible, but terms which have no similar consequence in classic Christian thought. Christianity tended to preach a gospel not of this world. There was, to be sure, a city of God, but it was a heavenly Jerusalem, a mystic place beyond time and space where the saved, the blessed, congregated and were rewarded. The things of this world, the building and the planting, the sowing and the reaping, were best left to the leaders of this world. Render unto Caesar the things that are unto Caesar, and unto God the things that are unto God. To be preoccupied over much with city, nation building, with the practical things of life, was to be trapped, to be moved away from that which was truly consequential, the care of the soul. Meeting the trials of life in such a way, with such a faith, as one would be guaranteed salvation in some future world. Now, this theological difference between Christianity and Judaism is not without immediate consequence. Any of us who have tried to explain this very special love of Israel, love of the promised land, which has played so much of a role in our faith, any of us who have tried to explain to theologically oriented non-Jews the importance of land, of a holy land, in our religious tradition, have found that to a large degree we are speaking to people who find it very difficult to understand that such terms as land and holy land and promised land can have theological import and implication. But there it is. And we cannot understand Judaism without recognizing how tied to the concepts of land and promised land and holy land our particular tradition is. The very first word addressed by God to the very first Jew, Abraham, was that he should leave his home and his patrimony and to go to the land that I will show you. And the very first covenant struck between God and one of the patriarchs, God and Abraham at Shechem, was a covenant in which Abraham promised obedience, and God promised, "Latet lachem ha'aretz hazot l'rishta," that it will give to you and to your seed this land as an everlasting inheritance. And when Moses led the children of Israel out of Egyptian bondage, there was no question as to their destination. It was the promised land. When Moses had received his commission at the burning bush, God had said to him, "I have seen the afflictions of my people. I am come down to deliver them, to bring them up to a land that is large and good, a land flowing with milk and honey, unto the land of the Canaanites." And ever after, our people have to a certain degree, defined the messianic hope in terms of a return to that land, Liyot et Am Chofshi Ba'atzenu, to be a free people in our own land. Land is a category of theology among Jews. And the love of land is found etched in almost every line of biblical poetry. Jeremiah said, Nahalat Tzvi Tzvaot Goyim. The land is a patrimony fairer than that of any other people. And again, the Bible exhausts itself in adjectives and in phrases which describe the beauty of the place. The Lord your God is bringing you to a rich land, a land of streams, of springs, and underground waters gushing out in hill and valley, a land of wheat and barley, of vines, fig trees, and pomegranates, a land of olives, oil, and honey. It is a land where you will never live in poverty nor want for anything, a land whose stones are iron ore, and from whose hills you will dig copper. You will have plenty to eat, and you will have good cause to bless the Lord your God for the rich land that he has given unto you. The promised land was a promising land, but it was also a holy land. And a holy land requires holy living. And so the Bible is full of admonitions as to the care of the land, the careful stewardship of field and forest required of our people. If Israel was not careful of God's patrimony, the land would vomit it out. The land was a beautiful place and must be kept beautiful, not only in terms of landscape, what we would call today ecology, but in terms of the kind of civilization which was established on the land. Israel was not allowed the ordinary vulgarities and indecencies and violence of ordinary people. God had ordained a law of righteousness. And in that land, Israel was to live in obedience to that law, righteously. And if Israel failed, they would not long be tolerated in the land. They would be driven off and exiled. The land required of Israel a response of character, a response of community, a response of quality. And hopefully, such would be the quality of the civilization of the cities which would be built in that land, that a light would go forth from Zion. An example would be set which would inspire other peoples and other communities around the world. Now, I cite this theology of land and these ideas and attitudes associated with it, because for most of the 19th and early 20th century, the American spirit, which we're discussing in this series, was very much etched in a similar theology and evidences many of the same attitudes. John Cotton, one of the early Puritan preachers, spoke of this providential Eden, which God had espoused and plotted and planned for us. Jonathan Edwards, the great New England revivalist, spoke of the importance of building the kingdom of God in the promised land. And the promised land was his New England, the place here where he found himself. The American forefathers believed, most of them, that this land was a promised land, a very special kind of land. And they delighted, as had the biblical writers, to sketch out and to draw its beauty. And whether we're turning to Washington Irving's sketchbooks or Thomas Jefferson's rhapsodic descriptions of the Shenandoah Valley, or later to those magnificent descriptions of the Far West, of Francis Parkinson or of Rogers and Clark, wherever we turn in the early writings of our people, when they deal with this earth, this land, this place, they delight to describe its beauty, its grandeur, its majesty. They stand reverent before it. Truly, this is a promised land, the gift of a gracious and kind God to this people. One has only to view the landscapes of the early American painters of Jasper Crosby or Frederick Church or any of their followers and disciples to see, to sense the awe of the early American before the continent, the beauty which God had placed here. And this reverence for the grandeur of this place remained part of the very essence of whatever we call the American spirit, right down to almost to this generation. Some of you may remember the poem that Dr. Silver wrote some 50 years ago, which is still used as part of our confirmation service. It's a poem which still speaks in the terms of the reverence for this place as a promised land, which was so much a part of the American spirit. God built him a continent of glory, filled it with treasures untold. He carpeted it with soft rolling prairies and columned it with thundering mountains. He studded it with sweet flowing fountains and traced it with long winding streams. He planted it with deep shadowed forests and filled them with song. Then he summoned and he called into 1,000 peoples and summoned the bravest among them. They came from the ends of the earth, each bearing a gift and a hope. The glow of adventure was in their eyes and in their hearts the glory of hope. And out of the bounty of earth and the labor of men, out of the longing of hearts and the prayer of souls, out of the memory of ages and the hopes of the world, God fashioned a nation in love, blessed it with a purpose sublime, and called it America. This promised land was a promising land, and Americans had something of the sense of awe, of holiness, which ancient Israel had shared. Whenever a Jew went up to the land, he made aliyah. He somehow climbed closer to God. Prophecy occurred only in the Holy Land. God was everywhere, but somehow he was most specially there in that place. And one finds something of that same sense of the closeness of the presence of God in this promised land in American thought. Perhaps the most creative theologian of the 19th century in America was Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson began his career as a rather ordinary New England Unitarian, a graduate of Harvard and of Harvard Divinity School, scholarly and wise, but without having made any unique contribution to theological thought. And as he matured in scholarship and in the pulpit, Emerson became more and more dissatisfied with the religious ritual of his day. It seemed to him too place-bound, too much inside the church. It seemed too much to be too much limited by ritual, by repeating of old phrases about the history of Jesus who had lived so long ago. He came to feel that faith, religion, was nothing if it was not a surge of feeling, a very private, very immediate experience. And how was one to come to this surge of feeling, the religious experience? Well, the quickest way and the easiest way was really to walk out into nature, to look at the sunshine and the sunset, the clear streams and the endless forests, to open one's soul, the divine that is within soul, into the divine that is within nature. And then there is true religious communion, a true mystical experience. Emerson was wont to say that the aspect of nature is devout, and that the happiest man is the man who learns from nature the lesson of worship. As we stand before the grandeur that is the grandeur of this place, so virgin, so pristine, so much as God had originally made this world, one sensed the creative might and genius of God. And if one was able to respond and open oneself to response, then true humility and awe and reverence grew in the human soul. There's a very special reverence of land, reverence of place, the theology of Protestant America in the 19th and early 20th century. This was a promised land and a promising land. and a holy land. And since it was holy, it required a very special kind of living. And the best of the preachers and teachers of the day spoke of a very special consecration required of Americans to be worthy of the great gift, the grand gift which God had placed before them. They were to welcome all men as brothers. They were to live openly and freely as good and cooperating neighbors. There was to be democracy, spiritual concern, and righteousness among the people. And just as in ancient Israel, there had been a sense that a new creation was coming to place on the Holy Land, a very new kind of living. Just as Israel was commanded to separate themselves from the abominations of the Amorites or of the Canaanites and to build a new society. So in 19th and 20th century America, there was the feeling that here we were about to build an entirely new creation, something unheard of before in the world. The old world was corrupt. The new world must be consecrated. The old world was sullied by 1,000 years of violence and of war, of class antagonism, of the arrogance of place, of birth, of nobility, by the separation between the have and the have-nots, the rich and the poor. This nation had been born in freedom. It was a constitutionally based society. There was to be justice and righteousness and equality here. There was enough here for all. The old violence of the world was to be left behind across the ocean. And here a very new world was to emerge. Walt Whitman sang, you may remember, all the past we leave behind. All the past we leave behind. We debouch upon a newer, mightier world, varied world, fresh and strong, the world we seize, world of labor, the march, pioneers, oh pioneers. All the past we leave behind. Biblical laws of Avodah Zarah, the biblical laws of idolatry, represented all the past that Israel was to leave behind. All of the vanity, all of the class divisions, all of the coarseness, all of the vulgarity of an older civilization. And here a new and better and holier civilization was to rise. Well, that was the most effective and most valid part of the American theology of land of the last century or so. But unfortunately, America's attitude towards land did not stop with this sense of new possibility. The sense that America was different became often the sense that America was exceptional. We not only had been given by God a new opportunity to pioneer in a fresh land, to create something that could avoid many of the mistakes of the past. But somehow God had given us this promised land, and we were somehow uniquely worthy of the land. And here we had created ideas and institutions which were very special, and we had only to fulfill ourselves and God's mission for us. We had only to impose these institutions and these values on the rest of the world. Manifest destiny is very much an outgrowth of this theology of land. As America gobbled up the continent, mid-continent, Louisiana through purchase, Texas through war, California through purchase and war, we began to justify this movement west, this ingestion of land. First the contiguous lands on the continent, and then parts of the old Spanish Empire as we became imperial, by a doctrine of manifest destiny, which said in effect, to use a phrase of Walt Whitman, we are a redeemer nation. We have a right to these peoples and these lands because here is a better way of life. By taking over other places, we will add to the sum total of human happiness and human possibility in a way which could not occur otherwise. Here we have the beginning of that attitude towards the world which Americans, I think, shared largely into our generation. That somehow our way of life was the only valid set of political and social ideals, and that we ought in one way or another to encourage or to force the world to accept these ideas and these ways, these institutions. as the only way to achieve a happy future. Woodrow Wilson, the beginning at the end of the 19th century, picked up the theme that Walt Whitman had spoken of it in the first half of the century as the Redeemer Nation. And when he was still a historian, before he became president of Princeton and president of the United States, said this in one of his volumes, during the movement west, during the years of Manifest Destiny, America had the infinite privilege of fulfilling her destiny and saving the world. America had the infinite privilege of fulfilling her destiny and saving the world. Now, there was much that was fine and much that was noble in the American experiment. We were moving towards a largely middle-class social order. The Constitution guaranteed citizenship to all. There would be no arbitrary divisions of class, no aristocracy and proletariat. But the America of Walt Whitman was still an America in which there were millions upon millions of slaves. The America of Woodrow Wilson was an America in which every ship debouched into New York and Boston, Philadelphia, thousands of men and women drawn here to be labor, cheap labor, gringo labor for the mines and the mills, brought here without any thought to housing or to education or to a decent standard of living, brought here simply to increase the profits of those who we now call the robber barons. America in the 19th century was a place for those who were part of the abundance of America. For the upper class and the middle class, it was a very graceful society. But it was a place of migrant farm workers, a place of child labor, until the Civil War, a place of slavery, and after the Reconstruction, a place of indentiture, a place of sharecropping. It was a place of crowded slums and crowded tenements, a country which did not avoid the abysmal poverty of the industrial age. If America had taken the concept of holy land and requiring holy living, and had tried with every fiber of its energy, of its civic energy, to meet and to solve the many social problems here at home, the concept of land and of promised land, of holy land, would have been a wholly beneficent one. In the Bible, as you know, land is a contingent promise. Israel is brought to the promised land, but not offered it in perpetuity. But rather, the terms of the covenant are these: if you are willing and obedient, you shall eat of the good of the land. But if you are violent and disobedient, you shall be driven off the land. If you are righteous, the heavens will bring forth rain, the earth will bring forth its produce. If you are sinful and violent and crude and callous, the heavens will be kept shut, and the earth will be barren of produce. Part of Israel's theology was the possibility of our being driven off the land, and in fact, the fathers were driven off the land time and again, according to the prophets, because they had failed to abide the terms of the covenant. But in 19th and 20th century America, there were many who believed that God's covenant with the Americans was an eternal one, an unconditional one, that we were here and we deserved to be here and we would remain here strong and prosperous and powerful regardless of the level of our character, of our corporate character, regardless of our concern or lack of concern for justice, for equality, for opportunity, for freedom. Now, I suspect that in the last generation or so, most Americans have disabused themselves of this concept of American exceptionalism. Most Americans no longer believe that we are the innocents and the saintly and the pious and the only concerned, socially concerned nation on the face of the earth. We still have great faith in many of our American institutions. But we've been forced to acknowledge an America which it can be and has been imperialist, an America which has been and can be racist, an America which has been and can be callous of poverty, An America which has been and can be contemptuous of the lives and the subsistence of minorities, the Indians, and so on. We've had to recognize that there's a mote in our own eye, as well as sinful people and venal communities out there elsewhere in the world. And many of us sometimes are moved to sigh with regret at the great opportunity which existed in an earlier America, before this world, this country was chuck full of poverty, before population had grown to its present estate, before the frontier had all been eaten up. We're somehow moved to sigh about opportunities lost. And yet, truly, if we can recapture the best of the elements in this concept of land, promised land, and holy land, I think there may be benefit for us. I sometimes feel that in our loss of innocence, as in the last generation or two, we've come to see, all of us, the mote in our own eye. Many of us have been moved to criticize too bitterly, too harshly, the American experience. Much that was unworthy took place, but much that was worthy has taken place. This is a free society. The Constitution is still in place. The individual, the family have rights here they have almost nowhere else in the world. We have truly moved to create an open society. We speak of the other America, the poor and those who lack privilege. And there is another America, but it's another America perhaps of 20% or 15% of the Americans. Not as in many other lands of 60 and 70 and 80 and 90% of the population. We have come a goodly way, but we have not come all the way that we should come. And somehow I find that in a very much more sophisticated way, Americans of our day are groping towards a new appreciation of these biblical terms, land, promised land, and holy land. What is the ecological movement? But an attempt to find again, to establish again the promise of a promised land. And what are the concerns for social reform, for the larger justice, for racial justice? But a concern that there shall be holy living in the Holy Land. And if we have lost the sense of American exceptionalism, that arrogance, that hubris, that very special pride which was the hallmark of an earlier generation, perhaps that's all to the good. For we live now not hidden behind several oceans, but as part of a very compact little planet called Earth. We cannot hide away from the problems of the world, and we are not the only people of the world who are morally and spiritually and politically concerned. It's good to recognize that we share that which is called humanity. But it is also good to recognize that we have in this land a very gracious home. And if we cannot call it the promised land, certainly it is full of promise. And if it is not the holy land in the sense that it is especially holy, it is a land which can hallow our efforts if we will redouble them and serve all that is of consequence, value. Amen.